This is the Transcend Human Podcast, a show dedicated to the spirituality and psychology of the human condition. This year, however, we're taking a detour together as I venture into the world of writing. Each episode documents my journey from the big idea to a complete fiction novel. Join me through the highs and the lows that are sure to be part of this creative process. Okay, friends, we are back. Welcome to the Transcend Human Podcast, or more specifically, the Transcendent Trilogy Series. The new series we dove into this year, and the series which has no end, at least no foreseeable end in sight. Glad you chose to join us. It is March 4th, 2024. Welcome back to the program. Today's topic, plotting versus pantsing. Chapter 1. Oh, to be a pantser. Chapter 2, it all comes down to personality. Chapter 3, plotting the trilogy. Chapter 1, oh, to be a pantser. So we touched on this a little bit in the last episode, and I really don't want to spend a lot of time on it here, but when it comes to writing, there seems to be two high-level variations that most writers fall into. You have the pantsers. Those are the people who are able to just sit down and write from the seat of their pants with very little to no preparation. And then you have the plotters, who require a higher level of structure, organization, outlining, that sort of thing, in order to complete their project. According to Susan Boyd, pantsers enjoy the act of discovery as they allow their imaginations and their characters free rein to craft the story. Rather than focus on a detailed plot, they look through the eyes of their characters to develop each scene. Whereas plotters prefer the structure of outlining the plot before settling into their novel writing. They use mind maps, note cards, written summaries of each chapter or scene, or even hand-scribbled charts. Resources abound with guides to plotting a novel. Now, according to Boyd, here are some famous pantsers. We've talked about Stephen King before, but we have Margaret Atwood, Mark Twain, and Raymond Chandler. And then there's a few famous plotters. You have J.K. Rowling, John Grisham, and E.L. Stein, among others. Now, the title of this chapter was Oh, to be a Pantser, which kind of suggests what? First, that I'm probably not one, and second, that maybe I kind of wish I was, which is true on a very surfacey level. I look at the pantser's life, and I'm jealous. I picture Stephen King getting an interesting idea in his head, sitting down, and banging out 6 pages a day, not even knowing the full plot or the full ending of the book. And because of who he is, it just unfolds in his mind. And pieces come together over time until the book is done, in many cases, in a few months' time, at least to complete the first draft. To me, that is amazing. That's, to me, what a true writer must be, right? A truly artistic and creative mind at work. And at first blush, I wish that was me. For those of you listening, you won't be able to see this, but I put a picture of me with Stephen King in the show notes. Now, before you're like, no way, man, when did you get to meet him? I'll spoil it. It's a life-size cardboard cutout I just happened to find in a bookstore in San Diego. But I love the picture because it's probably the closest I'll ever get to Mr. King in real life. Although, interesting tangent, I was with my family on a spring break trip to Florida 1 year. We signed up for a paddleboard excursion. And we were out on the water for most of the day, but around noon, we pulled into a small cove, and we pulled our paddleboards up out of the water, and we ate our lunch. Then we did a short hike along the coast, taking in the amazing coastline and some of the large homes set just off the beach. And wouldn't you know it, one of those homes belonged to Stephen King. If he was home at the time, I was less than a football field away from him. So there's that. But back to our episode. So I found a really interesting YouTube video in my research this week, and I linked to it in the show notes. It's basically a montage of clips from interviews that Stephen King has done over the years, and the creator simply calls it 10 Writing Tips from Stephen King. I'm not going to walk through each of them today, but if you have an interest at all, I think you should really check it out. It's pretty good stuff. Chapter 2, It All Comes Down to Personality. So here's when I say, but. Oh, to be a pantser, but. But what? Well, for me, it's, but what about my personality? Because that's just not 100% my personality type. I find myself at times lost in a scene, and I almost feel like a pantser for a moment or two. But then the inevitable happens. I've written myself into a cul-de-sac, a dead end, and I have to rewrite myself out of that dead end in order to get back on track. Now, maybe this isn't all personality. There's a chance that it's because I've never written a full novel before. Maybe it's just inexperience. I don't know. But let's just start with personality, because I'm really feeling that part of it right now. For those of you with an understanding of the Enneagram personality test, this will make a lot of sense. The Enneagram has 9 types, each one plotted around a circle, each interacting with the other numbers, either because they're adjacent or because they're directly across from that number, but for very specific reasons. Now, I won't go into the details, but I did want to talk very high level about just 2 of the numbers, specifically 4 and 1. An Enneagram 4 is called the individualist. They are described in the following way. 4s maintain their identity by seeing themselves as fundamentally different than other people. 4s feel like they are unlike other human beings, and consequently, that no one can understand them or love them adequately. They often see themselves as uniquely talented, possessing special, one-of-a-kind gifts, but also as uniquely disadvantaged or flawed, more than any other type. 4s are acutely aware and focused on their personal differences and deficiencies. 4s are inspired and highly creative. They are able to renew themselves and transform their experiences. Now let's look at the Enneagram 1. The 1 is called the Reformer, and they are described in the following way. 1s have a sense of mission that leads them to want to improve the world in various ways. Using whatever degree of influence they have, they strive to overcome adversity, particularly moral adversity, so that the human spirit can shine through and make a difference. They strive after higher values, even at the cost of great personal sacrifice. Well-organized, orderly, and fastidious, they try to maintain high standards, but can slip into being critical and perfectionistic. Now, obviously, these are just 2 of the 9 numbers, but I chose them on purpose because I think it highlights something very important. And if I were to be extremely stereotypical right now of 4s and 1s, I would probably say the following. 4s are highly creative, they give birth to their ideas, and are just a little different than everyone else. 1s are probably highly ordered, they need proof that something will work in order to do it, and they tend toward perfectionism. Again, complete stereotypes, and never 100% true all of the time, but it should be obvious based on personality, which group would tend to be pantsers, and which would tend to be plotters. And since I'm an Enneagram 1, it just makes sense, right? That plotting might be the thing that's up my alley. Again, my assumption is that there could be an Enneagram 1 out there who's a pantser. Well, maybe they're just highly perfectionistic about the ideas that they come up with. And I assume that there are probably some Enneagram 4s out there who might actually enjoy creating an outline every now and then as part of their creative process. But the takeaway here is that we're all different. Based on our personality, we most likely gravitate toward the writing style that matches our inner machinery, the way we're wired. And that's okay. For me, this means that I can be fascinated by pantsers, but aside from short bursts of it, in and out of my plotted out writing, I probably will never be a full-blown pantser. because my mind works much better with a foreshadowed road ahead, plot points outlined. Though simple they may be, providing a dimly lit path for me to follow, just enough guidance so that I don't end up in a cul-de-sac, and just enough direction so that I can map out things like the hero's journey, obligatory moments, genre conventions, all things that I'm assuming an editor would hound me about after reading my first draft. Chapter 3, Plotting the Trilogy. So if I'm truly a plotter, then I need to plot. And in recent years, I've come to understand that this may have been one of the main things holding me up, keeping me from just diving in and starting to write. The more and more I read about the hero's journey, story grid methodology, those types of things, the more nervous I became about the writing that I had already completed. But instead of going back and adjusting it to match, I just stopped writing, feeling dejected and nervous about the task ahead. But that's where things are different this time, because I'm at the point where I've owned the plotter title. And if that's truly who I am, then I need to plot out my work, something that I never really did formally in the past. Easier said than done, though, right? Because there is no set way to plot or outline your work. In fact, there are hundreds of ideas, many different frameworks from which to draw, but no clear path forward on which one to use and which is the most successful. Ultimately, it's up to you. You have to do what works for you. This is a mantra that I hear repeated over and over again on the Sobriety Uncensored podcast that I follow. The hosts, Daniel and Jenna, are quick to say that there is no right way to stay sober. The 12 steps of AA work for some people, but not everyone. You have to create the plan that will work for you, and work that plan every day for the rest of your life. And that's really what I'm feeling about the next steps for me as a writer. I need to pick a plan and stick to it, at least for now. And that plan is this. I'm choosing to take elements from the story grid methodology and use them to plot out the trilogy. Then I'm going to take the hero's journey story arc and overlay it in order to get a two for one, so to speak. Now, like I said, there are numerous other writing structures that you could choose. According to Kathy Edens, there are numerous, and here are just a few: the snowflake method, the 30-day method, the five-step method, write from the middle method, the five-draft method, the novel factory method. You can read up on each of these using the link in the show notes, but like I said, there are many different people with many different ideas as to how to plot out a novel. But again, I chose not to use any of these because I'm feeling pretty good about my current plan. Before we end today, I just want to read through one story grid element that has been super helpful in getting me started. It's called the 20 skeletal scenes. And we touched briefly on this in the last episode when we talked through the arithmetic of writing or the math of storytelling. To review, Sean Coyne suggests that you must abide by the five commandments of storytelling, which are inciting incident, progressive complications, crisis, climax, and resolution. And we discussed that these five commandments must be in every book, in every quadrant, and in every scene in order for your book to work. So taking this and applying it to the structure of your novel, if you have these five commandments in each of the following sections, the beginning hook, middle build one, middle build two, and the ending payoff, you do the math. You will have five commandments in each of the four quadrants, and 5 times 4 is 20. And that's where they come up with the 20 skeletal scenes. So let's walk through the 20 skeletal scenes for a novel in the action genre, starting with the beginning hook. First, you have an inciting incident, an attack or threat from the villain. Next, you have turning point progressive complications. So the protagonist senses disorder and realizes the nature of the threat. Next is crisis. The protagonist faces a choice to run away or reluctantly engage. The climax is what the protagonist chooses to do. The protagonist agrees to engage. The resolution is to fix it and forget it, or enter the mission. Middle Build 1, Inciting Incident. The protagonist sees a whole new world. Turning point, progressive complication. The protagonist becomes the target of the antagonist. Crisis. The protagonist faces a choice to comply or defy. Climax. The protagonist chooses, after which the antagonist asserts their dominant power. Resolution. The protagonist reaches the point of no return. Middle Build 2. Inciting Incident. The protagonist is dropped into chaos when encountering an unexplained event. Turning point, progressive complication. The all is lost moment. Crisis. How can the protagonist's death be meaningful? The protagonist faces a choice to go in the face of uncertainty or give up. Climax. The absolute commitment of the protagonist. And finally, resolution. The protagonist prepares to enter the ultimate arena. And finally, the ending payoff. The inciting incident. The protagonist enters the sanctum of the antagonist. Turning point, progressive complication. Someone the reader cares about dies. Crisis. Do the ends justify the means? Climax. The protagonist is at the mercy of the antagonist. And resolution. The protagonist is rewarded. So there you go. 20 short story prompts to get you started. Now, all you have to do is take those 20 scenes, is what they would be, and you need to rework each of those with the elements from your own story. And then you're on your way. Now you have an outline that can help keep you on track as you plot out and begin writing your story. But wait, I hear people saying, aren't you writing a trilogy? Yes, insert major wrinkle here. After hours of research, I came to the conclusion that there is a path forward on that front. You just have to add a layer, a very important layer. So go back to the 20 skeletal scenes and fill those out for the entire trilogy, the entire story. These 20 scenes will actually exist, sprinkled out over 3 complete novels. Next, go back and complete the 20 skeletal scenes for each book. Book 1, 2, and 3 will each have a set of the 20 skeletal scenes within them. This ensures that each book works separately, with a beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff that is satisfying for the reader. At the same time, this is why the second book in a trilogy is often so boring and so difficult to write, because even though it has its own beginning, middle, and end, its main job is to be the middle build for the entire trilogy. Next, once this is in place, it's time to overlay the hero's journey. Now, I'm not 100% sure or clear if this works the same way. In other words, if you need a hero's journey for the entire trilogy and then one for each book, or if it can just be for the higher level story over the 3 books. But at this point, my plan is to just start with the hero's journey as it relates to the entire trilogy. Then, if needed, work it into each book as a last resort. So here's the hero's journey in a nutshell. There are 12 scenes or 12 pieces to the hero's journey. And I'm just going to read through each one so that you kind of get a feel for it. The hero's journey begins with the call to adventure. So it's the moment when the hero receives a call to adventure, which could come in the form of a message, a dream, or an encounter with a mentor or a guide. Number 2, refusal of the call. At this stage, the hero may initially refuse the call to adventure, often due to fear, doubt, or a sense of inadequacy. Number 3, meeting the mentor. The hero encounters a mentor or a guide who provides support, advice, and guidance on the journey ahead. Number 4, crossing the threshold. The hero leaves behind the known world, or the ordinary world, or the world of present day, and crosses the threshold into the unknown, often referred to as the magical world, often encountering tests, trials, and challenges along the way. Number 5, tests, allies, and enemies. The hero must navigate a series of tests, trials, and challenges, often with the help of allies and the opposition of enemies. Number 6, the approach to the inmost cave. The hero approaches the inmost cave or the heart of darkness, often facing their greatest fears and challenges. Number 7, the ordeal. This is the moment of the hero's greatest challenge, when they face the major obstacle or enemy and must overcome it in order to continue their journey. Number 8, the reward. The hero achieves some sort of reward, often in the form of knowledge, insight, or a powerful object or tool that can help them in their journey. Number 9, the road back. The hero begins the journey back, often encountering new challenges and obstacles along the way. Number 10, the resurrection. The hero experiences a moment of death and rebirth, often symbolized by either physical or metaphorical transformation. Number 11, the return. The hero returns home transformed and changed by their experiences, armed with a new knowledge and insight that they can use to benefit their community. And number 12, the freedom to live. The hero achieves a state of freedom and enlightenment, often living happily ever after or in a state of balance and harmony. Now, one thing you'll notice right off the bat is that there is a lot of synergy between the 20 skeletal scenes and the hero's journey. StoryGrid uses standard literary concepts like protagonist and antagonist, while the hero's journey introduces us to new terms like heroes and enemies and mentors. But both have very similar through lines. And when you make sure that the elements of both are combined, the story simply takes on that much more depth. So here's where I'm at in the process. I've completed the 20 skeletal scenes for the entire trilogy. I've completed the 20 skeletal scenes for book one, and that's pretty much where I left off. Now, when I say that I completed the scenes, I don't mean I wrote the entire scene for each of those 20. I simply wrote 2, 3, maybe 4 sentences explaining what that scene would be about based on my story. So what do I have left to do? The 20 skeletal scenes for books 2 and 3. And finally, then I need to sprinkle the hero's journey elements throughout all of, at least throughout the trilogy, but then probably even throughout each of the 3 books. And that, my friends, is it. Let's land the plane. Whew, that was a lot. Not a long podcast episode, but definitely a lot to think about. But it's this kind of stuff that's actually kept me moving forward at this point in the game. As a plotter, this is exactly what I need in order to keep moving the ball down the field. Over the next few weeks, I hope to get all of my plotting down on paper, and hopefully after that, I can hit the ground running. At this point, I have my original 5 chapters just sitting out there, but they'll definitely need to be repositioned based on this new direction. And aside from those 5, I haven't written a single sentence to this point. So I can't wait for that day to come. I can't wait to get back to the actual writing part. I'm so excited. But like I said, I have to get this part done first. Otherwise, the writing isn't going to be productive. So I'll definitely let you know when I'm done with all of these things, for sure. As it will be a historic moment in time. Okay, that was a little dramatic. Not a historic moment in time, but definitely a historic moment for me, as this has definitely been a long time coming. So thanks everyone for hanging out with me this week. I hope you're doing well, and I hope that you have a project of your own, maybe one that keeps you up at night or gets you up early in the morning, whatever it is, writing, painting, dancing, theater, whatever it is, something that you're passionate about, something that you feel like only you can bring to the world. Until next time, friends, have a great week, and as always, keep transcending human.